Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow and Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, Mr. Ethan C plus Sachs. How's it going, my friend?
That's a great intro. You had that one all locked up. Sometimes Ben has a little pause. He's ruminating on how to introduce me. There was no hesitation this week. You had that locked and loaded, huh?
Straight in, baby. Yeah. Everything's a C plus.
Everything's a C plus. Wow, I'm not special. That's a shame. I'm doing well. I've been drafting Bloomburrow a little bit this week, and I've been drafting a lot of Vintage Cube this week.
Heck yeah, you have been posting videos of the Lords of Limited YouTube. I was like, ooh, 2 Ethan Vintage Cube videos on our YouTube stream. The YouTube algorithm is feeding me your content. I happily watched both draft videos, and it was great. Very much enjoyed your Road to Cube Worlds videos.
Yeah. I mean, I have like, it'd be a good problem to have, but like, you know, KubeCon is the weekend before Vegas. And so the idea that I could travel for Magic on back-to-back weekends, and it's really longer, like it dips into the week, like I'm already having my parents come out to do some Jonah coverage when I'm going to Madison for KubeCon coverage. So anyway, it's...
He'll almost be 2 at that point. He could look out for himself, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true. I think that's how kids work for sure. But it's still fun to play Cube for stakes. And like the entry for the feeder leagues is pretty cheap. So I don't know. I messed around with the feeder leagues again this weekend. I have a little bit of a taste for it, but probably won't be actually queuing. What have you been playing this week? I haven't really talked to you.
I've played a modest amount of Bloomburrow drafts, maybe a couple while I was doing an oil change on my car and some other things where I just had some dead time. But school, full session this week, full swing. We had a football game Friday night, Saturday practice. It's that time of year. And Bloomburrow has not really been doing it for me that much. So I've played some when I have downtime, but I have not largely, I think, moved on from the format at this point.
That's fair, but I do know that you made good on your promise or your challenge that you issued to yourself at the end of last week's episode, which is that you did get a chance to draft Builder's Talent.
Oh, that's a lie. I have played a lot of Bloomburrow. This is a long week. So no, I have done. So there was some separation. I did play a lot with Builder's Talent, and I drafted Builder's Talent like 3 to 4 times with zero success. I think
no.
O2 drop, and then I was done with the format. And initially, I did have a lot of fun.
Wow. Decks.
And since then, I have only done 1 to 2 drafts. Not great advertising for last week's episode.
I mean, I would just say that's some user error. Though I did find it funny. Someone did comment. They were like, "You got me all fired up," and I went 0-3 with a Builder's Talent deck, and so I will expect my 1500 gems in my
account. In the mail, yeah.
I saw that. that's fair. Well, I don't know what to tell you. I weirdly, like, I don't love the format, but I do. I'm still enjoying it. I had an interesting draft. We probably won't have time for a draft log this week, but we might, if we do, check it out. That I had one where I was trying to draft the deck that you described, the like a red-black control deck, red-black spells deck, and then had to pivot off of it into some really late blue-red. I don't know how much you've seen of DeFore is in peak DeFore form on
peak
Twitter.
Worst archetype number one.
Yes,
number one.
Exactly.
Best of one, yes.
DeFore is at number one mythic drafting exclusively, it seems like, blue-red, which is the air quotes worst archetype in the format. And you just love to see it. You love to see someone doing their on-brand stuff to success.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I don't know. I haven't stopped playing the format, but Vintage Cube has caught my eye a little bit the past few weeks. And I don't hate it as much as I do feel like there's a lot of hate for Bloomborough. I don't feel that, but I'm obviously not. It's not like an all-timer for me or anything. But this week, as we teased at the end of last week's episode, was you the other challenge you issued was that you want to let me cook a little bit more during card evaluation season. And I wanted to take an opportunity as we're winding down with the format. 50 takes will be next week. Duskmourne is on the horizon. I wanted to take an opportunity to check in with card evaluations. And I think it'll be we'll have a broader conversation about card evaluations in the Play Booster era. And then I also wanted to just sort of dive into some of the misses that I personally had. And I think we'll both talk about our personal misses, but my own misses, and pick your brain about maybe some ways to rejigger how I'm thinking about card evaluations in the Crash Course season, so that I can maybe try and have a little bit of a leg up. Because I feel like sometimes I'm thinking optimistically and I get there, and sometimes I definitely do not get there. And I also think too pessimistically. So a lot of stuff there that I'm very selfishly looking forward to this episode, because I think it's going to help me grow. And I think it'll be great. We don't have a chance for these kinds of episodes a lot. And I think giving our listeners maybe a peek into how we're thinking about evaluating cards for better or worse will help them to get a leg up for the next set on the horizon as well.
Yeah, just take stock where everybody's at.
Everybody's at, exactly. So we'll do some housekeeping, then we'll get into that episode. So first things first, the Patreon page, patreon.com/lordsoflimited, is where folks can go to give back to the show. We have some cool stuff cooking up over at the Patreon page. We'll be announcing in the coming weeks. Really, really excited about all that. But we have great things there right now as well. We've got access to the Lords of Limited Discord. New set season will be coming up in a few weeks, and that's a great time to get in on that community of like-minded limited individuals talking about all things Duskmourne as the previews start to trickle through, and then we get, you know, the full set spoiled, and you get to do your tier lists and compare those with other people and do some practice drafts via that that Draftmancer app, and all that good stuff is really awesome to see popping off in the Lords of Limited Discord, and some perks as you move up the reward tier rankings as well. And we also want to shout out our new patrons the first week that they join. So this week we're welcoming Bill, Ben, and Troy. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your support.
You'll love to see it. 100% more Bens than there are Ethans in that list of people.
Sheesh. We had a good week that one week, the Ethans did, but the Bens are consistent for sure.
That's right. We are nothing if not reliable people.
That's right. That's right. So let's chat about Play Booster card evaluation in general. I think that's a good place to start, because, you know, for what it's worth, and maybe a mea culpa is in order here, but, you know, I definitely came into Play Boosters thinking, what's the big deal? What's the big shift going to be? It's not going to be that different, right? And I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's worse, but it is markedly different, I think, than draft boosters were.
Well, I think because in addition to the pack coalition, they're also making changes in how they're designing cards.
Yes.
For the pack coalition. Like, that's the bigger thing than missing a common and there being a few more uncommons. It's that they're shifting the types of cards they place at each rarity. So that's huge. And I think, kudos to you, I was not on this wavelength, but the uncommons are way more important than the commons, I think, as we're heading into new sets.
And important is a pretty vague term. So maybe we can unpack that a little bit. And what does that mean in terms of, like, important to anchoring your card evaluations, important to signaling you in draft? Like, what do you mean when you say important?
I don't mean in terms of card evals. I mean in terms of shaping the format. Like, mm-hmm. where, like, my favorite thing to do is, you know, after a few 4 or 5 drafts during the early access, try to get a picture of what I think the format is, what the best cards are, what the best archetypes are, what the best color is. Like, I think that's a strength of mine. And typically, I would be basing that around commons. And I think once you've shouted that the uncommons matter a lot more, that led to a couple chain reactions for me, which was valuing the uncommons higher in that eval for myself. But also, that led me to realize kind of the stuff about the signpost uncommons and the fact that they're double dipping there now in the signpost things really changes how those impact the format. I think before it was kind of like 10 things that were like, what's this archetype trying to do? You know, still having kind of the limited resources mentality about it. For me, now that there's like an uncommon and a common that are signposts, or in some formats it's 2 uncommons, but there's always been double of something for rewarding right. you for getting a new archetype at this point. If both of those cards hit, it's almost certain to be one of the top archetypes, I think, is yeah. what I found.
Here's a question. Did you see any of the discourse on Twitter this week about, you know, people talking about the community at large being too concerned with what's the best color or color pairs in formats?
I did see that, yeah.
How does that play into this idea of recognizing what the best archetypes are via these signposts or gold commons and uncommons?
I mean, I think it matters. I would yeah. say it matters more than what the Twitter discourse was saying. Like, the general thing that I saw on Twitter, and maybe I'm wrong because I only, as you said, peeped it. I did not get very deep into the weeds. But the general gist I got was that the pro community was saying, well, people are too hot on this. Or the streaming community was saying people are too hot on this early on. Like, the people come into a stream and say, what's the best color? What's the best archetypes? And it's like day zero. I mean, you and I are trying to figure that out, or at least I certainly am.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting to me. And I do think it does matter, and certainly it matters in best of one arena play, right? Like, knowing the best archetypes and the best colors to bias towards early on when people don't know what's up. Like, you can basically just force it. And same way that DeFore is probably able to force blue-red now because everybody knows what the best colors are and
right.
all the information has seeped out into the community. And so people are biasing away pretty hard from the worst stuff. I think it does matter. And I think it's helpful knowledge. And I think, yes, draft is self-correcting. And, you know, people who are excellent at draft, like the LSVs and the pros of the world, like they're probably looking at it more from the perspective of a pod at a pro tour or something.
Right.
Does it matter there? It matters way less. Like, you still need to know it, but like actively going out and trying to draft it or have actionable information about that, less important, I think, at the pro level when everybody at the pod has correct card evals and knows what the best color is and knows what the best archetypes are and knows how much they want to fight for it, that sort of stuff. Their draft is a lot more self-correcting, but I think certainly on Arena, you get a big edge from knowing what's up. And I think 17 lands kind of gives you the answers after the first 4 or 5 days of data comes out generally, but I still like trying to figure it out on my own. It's a very big part of the puzzle that I enjoy for playing Magic.
Well, and I think the important thing there, and I agree with what you've said, is that even if you're not acting on it, like, just because you know what the best color or color pairs are in a given set, like, that doesn't mean that's what you're going to force or whatever. And like that, knowing that, having that knowledge in a best of one pod, as you're saying, maybe you can bias towards it a little bit more versus at a pro tour pod, you might even then think about biasing towards it less because you're like, well, everybody knows this, so what's the level 2 thing I can do? Like, sure, I'd liked someone, you know, as we kept talking about when I was prepping for the Murders of Karlov Manor pro tours, like thinking about that sort of game of chicken drafting white, like white was the best color in that format. And so the game of chicken of, well, someone's got to draft white at the table, right? Multiple people get to draft white, could be me, but then thinking about what is gonna, you know, get you anchored in that color, what's worth that tussle, that fight with the 7 other people at the table, versus what are things, you know, the other thing that I feel like maybe it was even around that time that we started talking about this in these terms, but what are the things that give you incentives to draft perhaps less desirable colors? And those are also valuable too. Like if you start with like a Mockingbird in this format, for example, if blue is a less desirable color and you have an incentive to draft blue. If you open a Mockingbird, that's even better because like you already have an ace in the hole in a color that you expect to be underdrafted. And so then you can support that with hopefully good uncommons in that color that people will be passing that you wouldn't necessarily want to take as your first blue cards. But once you have the Mockingbird, you're happy to take them.
Right. The second drafts, like the drafts, I blocked out the Builder's Talent drafts, but the latter drafts this week that I had done in Arena, I opened blue rares in both drafts. And it was actually more enjoyable because I was in best of one, which I hadn't played in a while. And I felt like I was able to draft blue responsibly without giving up equity. And I both decks were good, and I had fun drafting and piloting them. But that's so rare, I think, in best of one that you have an incentive to go into blue like that in this format.
Well, in the early weeks, I had your voice in my head a lot of times when you were just like, I just hate passing green cards. And I had that happen to me a few times where like pack three, I opened a Hunter's Talent and I was like, man, it really stinks that I can't take this right now. The chain reaction started to want me to start draft screen when possible. Baker's Bane duo skyrocketing in my pick order because if I can just get deep into that color, there's such a wealth of opportunities at higher rarity that I can open. I can open a lot of really strong uncommons in green if I just give myself that opportunity in pack two and pack three.
So I don't know. Personally, I mean, we're a little off the rails here, but I would say that top color matters and top archetypes matter. Now, like, are people going to be as invested as me in trying to figure it out day zero? Probably not, which is why people, you know, are pushing back against people coming into streams and asking all those questions. But I think those are also questions, like, I think that is the crux of our podcast, essentially, right? Like, people want to know that so that when they have their time to do their one or two drafts per week, they feel like they have an edge, like when they sit down to their one or two drafts per week early in the format. So like those are so natural of questions to ask to me for like a person who loves Magic, has played a long time, is good, like would categorize themselves as a good Magic player. Like that's the information they want to feel like they have an edge when they sit down at their first draft.
Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. It's hot outside and your nighttime bedroom temperature has a huge impact on your sleep quality. If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets.
Miracle Made sheets are inspired by NASA and use silver-infused fabrics that are temperature regulating so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long.
Your sheets are like one big comfy sleeve for your bed. Not only do you want something to protect what's underneath, but it feels so nice to shuffle a deck with fresh sleeves on the cards. That's just what it's like climbing into bed when you've got your Miracle Made sheets on.
Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry.
Miracle Made sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands and feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some 5-star hotels.
Go to trymiracle.com/LOL to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%.
And if you use our promo code LOL at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. And if you aren't 100% satisfied, Miracle has a 30-day money-back guarantee.
Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/LOL and use code LOL to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off.
Again, that's trymiracle.com/LOL to treat yourself. And now back to the show. So back to this concept of uncommons are important. I think one of the things that you have listed here in our notes is that identifying the uncommons that are a cut above the rest matters a lot. Like those, you know, we used to think of them in the draft booster era as these mythic uncommons, but they're not mythic anymore because they show up a lot because of how the pack collation works now, right? It's not just 3 uncommons per booster, sometimes 4 or 5, whatever, but there's also, it's not just one ace in the hole. It's not just one like, oh man, that card is so sick. Like you get a lot of them. There's like probably, I mean, 10 in this format I can think of. And there might just be 10 like that amount in each set now in the play booster era. But like we already mentioned Hunter's Talent, Thoughtstalker, Warlock, we pegged, like everybody sort of knew that card was going to be nutso, and it absolutely is. Wix Patrol, a card that we'll get to a little later. Like, that's a card that I was too low on because of one of my, I think, Achilles heels as a card evaluator currently. But these are all just, like, you know, game-defining cards in Limited.
Yeah, I want to unpack each of these. Like, Hunter's Talent, I gave a B-2, which is probably too low. I mean, like, identifying that it pulled you into green is good. But, like, my tendency when I'm evaluating cards is to clump them into pulls me into a color or good card in that color, but doesn't quite pull me into that color. Like, I grade a lot around the B-, C-plus range, mm-hmm. which is probably where there are a lot of cards, to be fair. But missing on Hunter's Talent by that much hurts. Like, Hunter's Talent is an A.
It's an A.
Like, it is... the best uncommon in the format, I think.
Well, I'm going to get slight, like, I'm already just sort of like, my brain is traveling because we're already starting to refer to cards by letter grades, and it is just making me frustrated with how flawed I think the letter grading system is and just not knowing what the, like, next best move is. I know you and I are huge fans of Reasons versus Rewards. There's a small but mighty community that's a fan of Reasons and Rewards and the 5Rs. But I also understand that the 5Rs is flawed because how do you differentiate them? How do you know which ones are ranked above each other? But, like, the fact that I agree there is such a big clump at the C+, B- spot, which feels wrong because there is so much gradation there. But the overall takeaway of those things is what you're talking about, which is, like, does this pull me into that color or color pair or not, right? Does it make me want to stake a claim in that color or color pair? And yeah, Hunter's Talent, what's up?
I was going to say we should use the Dustin Stern 10-point grading scale. Get all those 5.1s, 5.2s, 5.3s.
Oh, the Dustin Stern, that spreadsheet, the color gradients there from, like, lighter to dark. It's a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing.
But yeah, missing on Hunter's Talent that hard. Like, I think I knew, but it was so simplistic to think about. It's a fight or bite spell plus, bite spell with upside. But not understanding, oh, you can pick it up with Sticky right. Tongue. Oh, Cash Grab can find it. And not to say, like, that's a lot. You know, you and I are trying to do a lot for the Crash Course. We're grading all the cards. We're assembling the, like, big picture stuff. We're prepping our arguments for our card disagreements. Like, there's a lot going on there that, to have thought about all of that, all of the synergy that Hunter's Talent could provide, plus its ability to just take over a long game, you know, I think that's okay to miss on that a little bit. But the faster you can identify that in week one, the more ahead of the curve you're going to be.
Well, sure. And I think just removal spell that is capable of also being a huge card advantage engine should, mm-hmm. like, even if you miss the Sticky Tongue stuff, I think we were too long. Thoughtstalker Warlock we hit because that card's obviously broken, right? Maybe even a smidge high. I think you gave it an A-, I gave it a B+. It probably is there-ish.
Yeah.
And then let's save Wix Patrol for okay. later.
That's fair.
So next thing with play boosters that has shifted for me is it's rare that you're getting into a color for commons. Like, the more I was thinking about grades coming into this episode, occasionally a B- creeps into a color at common. And usually as the format shakes out, you know, when we're grading cards, they're clumped in C+, B- type deal. But there are some commons that do end up pulling you into a color. Like, the commons that end up in the best color, their grades end up going up because you want to pick them more aggressively because you want to try to get into that color.
Mm-hmm. I think, right, all things mentally, being equal in, like, right. a weaker pack, that's where you want your direction to go.
It just happens so rarely, though, in play boosters now. And let's say you do open a weak pack and you first pick a common. The next pack is likely to have an uncommon or a rare that's pushing you more in a direction than that common, you know? Like, and just having that shift that it's, a for me as a Limited player, pretty fundamental in how I think about the format, that commons aren't really getting me into the decks anymore. That it is the uncommon, it is rares and uncommons and powerful cards, and a lot more of those are at uncommon these days because there are more of them per booster, and then you see them more. Like, you just see Hunter's Talent so much more frequently, and maybe you don't. I'm sure somebody could do the math. Like, I'm sure Sirkovitz has done the math or something like that, but it certainly feels to me like I see Hunter's Talent more now than I would have previously.
Yeah, I have to imagine that's true. Even, like, it's weird because there are more uncommons in the set overall than there were before in the draft booster era, but we're seeing so many more of them per pack than we were before, right? It was just like you were locked to see three in draft boosters, maybe a fourth if it was a foil or whatever. But that didn't happen on Arena, or like, you know, that wasn't happening digitally. And so now we're seeing, like I said, sometimes it's four, five, six uncommons in a pack. So it feels like they're definitely showing up a lot more. And so what are we doing with commons? You know, we shifted this past Crash Course, which I think was a good shift. We got overwhelmingly positive feedback about it, shifting from doing like a top three or two commons per color and just doing a list of top 10 overall. Here are the 10 commons we think are going to matter the most.
Yeah, I think that was a good shift. And I think the thing that I have tended to notice about commons is that the best commons are largely interactive. Like, it is your take out the trash, the 2-mana deal 3. It's your black kill something for 3 mana. It's saver, 1 and a black, -2/-2, make a food token. And that was largely true before, I think, but pre-play boosters, a lot of times the best commons were creatures. And like that still, I'm sure, can be true. But I feel like the thing the good commons provide most of the time now is interaction or answers to the premium threats that are at uncommon or rare.
Well, and another thing is so true. So I'm just pulling up 17 lands sorting by game and hand win rate. So seeing lots of interaction, seeing hand smoothing stuff for cheap. Three cards here, Carrot Cake, Cash Grab, and Pond Profit among the top 10. And I guess you could kind of lump Take Out the Trash on there, though I feel like I rarely get the rummage effect off of that because I don't often have a raccoon when I have that card. But, you know, that's a lot that commons are giving you. So I think it's not only cheap interaction, right? Efficient interaction, but at common is where you are getting that sort of little bit of, all right, this is going to help me develop in the early turns in a way that other cards might keep me stuck on two lands or whatever.
And some of that stuff was pre-play boosters as well, right? Rafine's Informant, for example, comes to mind from Streets of New Capenna.
Like, sure.
I think going into this format, the Lords of the Limited community, especially Sam, is coming to mind about championing the 1 and a blue 2/1 looter.
Like, yes,
that was Rafine's Informant, but that ultimately didn't pan out, partially because of blue being worse, but also not having the option to just make it a 3/2 when you didn't need the smoothing, you know?
Right. Yeah, for sure.
I think the next thing to get into thinking about play boosters and what's different is, I alluded to this earlier, but the idea of the double signposts and how much that leads you towards what the best archetypes are in the format. So sometimes it's an uncommon and a common, sometimes it's two uncommons, but they're doubling up. And if you hit it right, like let's say you get into the archetype, double the chances of getting past uncommons that only you can use, or maybe only you and one other drafter, or heaven forbid, if you're in the best archetype, two other drafters can use, is such a boon. And I think we've seen it enough of a trend this year with play boosters that I feel pretty confident going on record at this point that this matters a lot. So in Bloomborough, if we think about the signpost uncommons where both cards hit. So we talk about in green-black with Vine Reap Mentor and Corpseberry Cultivator. In blue-green, you've got the Pond Prophet and the 4/4 that blinks things. In green-white, you've got Head of the Homestead as well as Conclave Mentor, I think it is. The
Burrowguard Mentor, yeah.
Burrowguard Mentor. Okay, one of the Conclave Mentors, like a card from Guilds of Ravnica, I think.
Okay, Boomer.
Anyway, the Star Trample equal the number of creatures you have. Both of those cards hit in all those archetypes, and they're all the best archetypes. And then green is in all three of those archetypes, ergo green is the best color.
And so, and we sort of pegged, it's not like we pegged this, but I'm thinking about, we knew, we identified green-white. It was easy to see Head of the Homestead is nuts. Like, that's a really good card. It's actually not, like, you know, it's a top performing common or whatever, and it's very flexible, and so I bumped that up in my pick order as well in terms of it being hybrid. But we pegged that plus Burrowguard Mentor, like those two cards together were just, that's excellent. That seemed clear. Pond Prophet, I was a little less sold. I don't know why. Like, we'll talk about this a little bit later. Like, Pond Prophet, I think is part of my own, I have notes for myself that we'll get into later about Pond Prophet, but let's say you, I think, knew Pond Prophet and Lily Splash Mentor. Those were going to be great. I don't think, did either of us see Corpseberry Cultivator as being a mover and a shaker in the format?
I don't think so. Not going into it, certainly. No. But after playing with the cards,
yes.
Like I think after early, this, I'm saying post early access. Like after after doing 3 to 5 drafts,
because once you see that in action, you're like, oh, this food deck is ridiculous.
Right. So it was hard to peg going in because that type of deck tends to be a little finicky.
Think about the last time we saw food was in Lord of the Rings, and that it was like a cute, fun tier 2 thing to do, but it wasn't the best thing to do by a long shot.
Right. So going into this, I remember like early access or not pre-early access, I was thinking Jeskai. Like I was thinking mice and birds. Those are two of the worst ones, but that shifted quickly because that was based on conjecture that white was the best color. And I think white is a good color, certainly probably the second best color. But after early access, identifying that, oh no, after playing with the cards, green's the best color. These three green archetypes are great because all of their signpost commons hit. And that's hard to say without playing with the cards, I think. Mm-hmm. You can certainly conjecture and guess during pre-early access or pre-year first drafts for somebody who doesn't have early access. But I think ultimately you got to play with the cards. But I think after playing with them, you can pretty quickly start to make logical leaps like this to try to figure out best archetypes and best colors.
For sure.
And then also in Bloomboro, if you look at the worst archetype, blue-red, I think, nominally, unless your name's DeFore.
Right.
Both of those cards, the signposts there, are largely terrible. Like the Tempest Angler, the 2-2, the Spellgorger with the Grows, it's got the problem of it. You're doing work to get your cards the size of green's creatures. And then the uncommon, the 1-2 with prowess is
the 1-1.
1-1 with prowess? Yeah. It's so small. Like trying to grow that and make your spells cheaper, like they just don't do enough.
Yeah. No, that I think was also, you could see that from jump. I mean, I think just a Spellgorger Weird is an anomaly. Like that card, when it was first printed in War of the Spark, and War of the Spark is a set that you and I are both very fond of, I think that's why I get tricked by these Spellgorger Weird variants every time they're printed. And Spellgorger Weird is just not a good Magic card. Like, it just isn't. Like, it was good in a set where you were playing a bunch of Planeswalkers and it could trigger it, and there was Proliferate as a mechanic, but like, Spellgorger Weird just out in the wild is real bad.
Fair enough. And I think I'm not going to go into the cards, but the trend continues. Like I went back and looked at OTJ.
Yeah.
The archetypes with both hits were, again, some of the best archetypes. Green, white, green, black, white, red, white. Like I think those are four of the strongest or stronger archetypes, if not. And both of the signpost cards hit there. Mm-hmm. And Emergence Karlov Manor. It's blue, green. It's red, white. It's blue, white. White was the best color there. That was the first shout out to blue-green format since we got back to the play booster era. And it was because both the blue-green uncommons were nuts. It was the counter spell and put counters for X, as well as just make a clue every single turn.
Right. Yeah. With collecting evidence for. So I think that's a really, like you shouted that out. I think that was in Murders at Karlov Manor. You were like, I think now like identifying the two, like, when you have this pair, the movers and shakers of the format, because it like what you said, when you're going to get past those, right? If you're carving out that lane, it's probably one of the reasons DeFore is having success with blue red is like you carve out that lane. You just know you're going to get those cards. And not only do play boosters have doubling up either at uncommon and common or both at uncommon of the signpost cards, but there's also secret gold cards, like intentionally that's when the episode where we unpacked what the like Mark Rosewater's article about play boosters, that's intentional. There are now not only just the two cards for the archetype, but then there's cards that are monocolor but really sing in a specific two color deck, and then you get those late as well. And that's a powerful thing to do when you're in a specific deck.
And I think next thing to shout out for as far as play boosters go, and I'm curious as to how this hits you, but I think to me, one of the takeaways that I've had as far as trying to build a picture of the format quickly is identifying the best cards at common and uncommon. And maybe this is like our top 10 common segment kind of, but at uncommon, I also want to try, I think, more than just ranking the top three uncommons like we did this previous crash course, is like the uncommons that are a cut above the rest or a commons that are a cut above the rest. So like probably even within that top 10 list of commons, there's two or three that stand out among the 10. And certainly in the uncommons, like to be able to try to shout or peg like Hunter's Talent, Thoughtstalker, Warlock, Wix Patrol. Like, these are the cards that, regardless of color, we expect to be movers and shakers in the format and the foundation of the format being built upon.
I definitely see that for uncommons. It's hard for me to think, like, unless we're getting another Writhing Chrysalis somewhere. Because I'm even thinking of the top commons here, like, you know, do you really feel like Saver or whatever you think they are, Saver, Carrot Cake, Intrepid Rabbit, like whatever those top commons are for you, are they that much a cut above the other cards in the top 10?
I think I would say no for Bloomburrow, but like, if we have, and maybe it's not multiple commons, but if we have, if we see Drang preview season and Inspiring Overseer or something, like, I think it's important because we probably graded whatchamacallit, Writhing Chrysalis. We probably graded Writhing Chrysalis as a B minus when it was an A or like an A minus. So like, just trying to have a nod to these cards are really special and to try to grade them appropriately as such.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's fair. And I definitely think trying to identify whatever the top three, at least, of the, like, these are the uncommons that are going to move. These are the ones that are going to, like, define games. Is it time to talk about the grading scale?
Do we have to?
We don't have to.
No, we should. We should talk about the grading scale.
Because we've teased a lot, right, with our, you know, every Crash Course we get into it, and I get mad about how we're grading cards different, like, using different grades to describe similar cards, and, you know, now it's a meme of, like, it's great, it's a C+, it's fine, it's a C+, like, that... I mean, and I just even said this episode that I just feel like the grading scale is flawed. But at this point, it's like the Electoral College. I'm just like, it's broken, but I don't know how to, like, we're too deep in. I don't know how to fix it, you know? So what do you said? You told me, you teased before the episode, you said you have a hot take for this.
Well, we gotta get through this before we drop the hot take. But I think if we're talking about mea culpas with grading. Yeah. I think my biggest mea culpa or my biggest leak when I'm grading cards for the Crash Course is that I give cards that I think will be important to even one deck. If I think they have a really good home in a deck, I either give them a Synergy C+ or a C+. Like, I give out a lot of C+s. Like, C+ is the grade in my head for this card has a good home. And I think that's probably not the right letter grade to give those type of cards. Like, I'm sure I gave Scales of Shale a Synergy C+ because I thought it would have a good home in Lizards, you know?
But that's an interesting example because Scales of Shale just, like, plays well. It's at its best when you've got Lizards around, obviously, but, like, that card just plays well, and we've talked about it. Sometimes you just put it in decks where you've cast it for two and a black, you know?
Yes. Yeah. So that's fair.
That's not a great example, but I agree. I do think that is your tendency. And again, like, is Synergy as a grade augmentation helpful in that capacity? I don't know. Like, is it more helpful to say what the deck is specifically, like, rather than just a generic Synergy grade? I don't know.
That's fair. Yeah. And I also think I need to shore up being more, and we've shouted this already in the episode, but more particular with grades B minus and higher. Like, I give out so many B minuses, and very rarely do I give out B's, B pluses. And it's easy to identify the rares and mythic rares that get an A or an A plus or whatever. Right. But trying to actually see which of the cards that pull you into a color are better than others is something I'm going to try to pay attention to a little more in future sets.
So if we're calling these mea culpas or just, you know, my notes to myself, the changes I'm going to try and make as a card evaluator personally is I think I need to let go of, you know, rate and vanilla test stuff a little bit. Especially one of the things I noticed when looking at the cards I missed on this format and what my thinking was is that especially lower on the curve, I think I get really caught up with like Shoreline Looter is a really strong card in the format. The one in a blue 1/1 can't be blocked. Threshold, draw card when it hits, and if not, you're looting when it hits. And I was just like, ugh, I don't like a 2-mana 1/1. I don't want to play that, the thing that can't, like, tussle in combat. You know, the other cards that are cheap like that, like Bone Cash Overseer. I was like, ugh, 1-mana 1/1 that, like, has to do work to start drawing you cards. Like, sure, there's some context around that I missed. Like, you could put those cards in other sets maybe where they wouldn't hit as well. But I do think, like, rate like that matters less the less mana you're spending. Like, I think you can afford to not like be worried about massively impacting the board for one or two mana like that if it's going to give you either, like, you know, accruing value over a longer game, like both of those cards do, or just something like we're seeing a value on Shoreline Looter, on Carrot Cake, on Cash Grab, Malevolent Rumble, these cheap things that, yeah, maybe their rate isn't the best or whatever. You're not impacting the board massively, but it's not a lot of mana. And the what it lets you do is sculpt your future turns so well. And so that's one of the things that I'm gonna tweak. I think as you move up the curve, like sometimes I do think still like spending 4 mana for something like that, 5 mana for something like that is less desirable if you're not getting a good rate on what you're spending your mana on.
Right. A 4 mana 2/2 is way worse than a 2 mana 1/1.
Correct.
Because then you're going to be punished for not being on board a lot harder.
Yeah.
But I want to dive back into what you're talking about with the cash grabs and the Malevolent Rumbles and the Shoreline Looters. Like, that dovetails into those cards help you find other cards. And yeah. I think they help you find the cards that win the games.
That, like, matter.
That matter. Like, that's what I'm saying, where, like, I got to be more particular about, like, I felt this so hard during the Arena Opens. Like, this is when I was thinking about this, was Sealed on the Arena Opens. Like, in Bloomsboro, I played with no Hunter's Talents. And every time my opponent played a Hunter's Talent, like, I just lost. Like, it's so hard to beat that card because it does so much. Like, having that in your sealed pool versus not. And in draft, you have more agency about whether or not you're going to end up with one, or you can try to give yourself a better chance to end up with one. But that, or like in Modern Horizons 3, like whether my sealed pool could play Teemer and had to Writhing Chrysalis or didn't, like, you just feel so much what the best cards are, and you just play, like, in those high stakes events and people know what's up, you really do play a lot of best versus best when you're going for, you know, the 7-0s, or when you're at 6-2, or when you're at 5-2 and you're thinking, okay, maybe this is the run I'm going to qualify on. And it's not all that, but those cards are good because they help you find the cards that do win the game. And I the more I've played recently, the last 6 months, and maybe this is just I'm on a roller coaster with Magic, and this is I'm at a peak or a valley or whatever you want to call it. I don't know. But I really am feeling that, like, the number of cards that drive the outcome of the game is smaller and smaller to me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I guess
I want to be able to identify those cards and get them and find them as much as possible.
Yeah. No, it's that is a big, if that is true, and I think it is, that's a big mental shift for me. That is not like how I have, you know, I really like, and not to say you can't draft like this also, but I really like a drafting decks that are greater than the sum of their parts and building a machine or an engine. And I do think a lot of the times it is just like, you know, there's synergy in Bloomsboro, but it's also about finding your in those decks. You still have, they're not all created equal, you still have your best cards, and finding those best cards and casting them consistently wins you more games.
And I think that was less true in Modern Horizons 3, and I think certainly in something like, this is pre-play boosters, but in Dominaria United, so not to say that, like, they're not going to design formats where the power level is more flat,
correct,
but I think knowing about types of formats and being able to peg, well, this is a flatter power level format, so I'm going to have to build my own power in the draft, versus, no, there are some real power level spikes here at uncommon or rare or whatever, and I want to try to hit those power spikes, and I want to find those power spikes.
Yeah, Modern Horizons 3, I mean, Writhing Chrysalis aside, feels like an outlier, and I wonder if that's because it was, you know, a
master
not
set.
Master set, not standard legal, etc. But thinking about MKM and OTJ and Bloomsboro, I do think that it does feel a bit more like find your best cards, cast your best cards in a functional shell, obviously in a functional synergistic shell. That's great, but those best cards are going to win out for sure. Basically every card I was higher than you on in this crash course I was wrong about. And I can't, I just had adjusted the grades or something, but like, I thought that there were more. There definitely, I was like too high on the random discard spells. I had some pipe dreams there about like what Psychic Whirl was going to do, and it does nothing. I was thinking about, oh, but it's going to fill your graveyard for Threshold, etc. And, you know, Sinister Monolith, I was trying to stake a claim for as a good enabler. And I don't feel like that card really panned out in either red, black or white, black, really. Better in Sealed is just a bad divination for sure. But, you know, I don't think it was really that good. So it's not that I'm incapable of thinking optimistically about cards, but I do think my default is to think about the floor, to think about the worst case scenario of cards. And some cards that I, you know, looked, I was looking back at all of our grading spreadsheets from this year and some other cards that jumped out to me. One was Ral and the Implicit Maze from Modern Horizons 3. That was the 5-mana saga that dealt 2 to everything. And then you got to, I think, discard a card, exile 2, and play them until the end of your next turn. And then you made a Spellgorge Arrear. This was a spot where actually a Spellgorge Arrear was good when you got it with 6 other things. But, you know, instead of thinking about, man, the times when this does the thing are going to be excellent. And obviously the idea, the fact that there were, you know, it was a format of little Eldrazi tokens running around. And so you right. got to sweep those up. That made that card good. I'm not going to, you know, slap myself on the wrist for not catching that during Crash Course season. But just more thinking about, sure, there is a floor of this card, but there's also a ceiling of this card, and good Magic players are going to get the ceilings out of their cards more often when they draft with them, build their decks with them, cast them, and I think I need to be focusing on that. Trash the Town from Outlaws of Thunder Junction was the spree trick that, you know, if you did everything, it was like +2/+2 counters and trample and drew cards when it connected with your opponent. And I was like, this is just an expensive trick, blah, blah, blah. You know, I just tend to underrate tricks. Scales of Shale is another great example of like, I just underrate tricks. But like, again, good Magic players are going to find the spots to leverage, like to cast tricks in effective places. And when your trick does all those things, when it grows your creature, wins a combat, does and draws you card, leaves around a larger body, when your trick leaves your creature and you gain 4 life off of it and you're trading in combat, like when it's able to do all those multiple things, sure, there are times where it won't do it, but more often than not, it's going to do the thing. And so my note for myself moving forward is to just think more optimistically rather than pessimistically about cards.
Yes, I would say for sure. I think when I went from our conversations during the crash courses, I feel like you have a duty to as a content creator to be harsh on cards that wouldn't do well on Quadrant Theory from LR, for example, or, you know, build around do nothing type cards. Whereas I think you know what to, I think you should grade cards that you want to play with. That's what I do when I grade cards with me playing them.
Sometimes I say like Builder's Talent, I was like, this is a card that piques my interest, but I don't think it's going to be good, rather than being like, okay, there's a lot happening here. What can be happening here? Like is this worth doing? And I think you just get so much bang for your 2-mana upfront buck that, yeah, there is enough to do there, despite your 0-8 record with the card this week. Stocking the Pantry, though, like that is a card that's on our list, and maybe we should just get into this list now of things we missed on. But Stocking the Pantry is one that I was low on. That's the green enchantment. When you put a counter on something, you get a counter on Stocking the Pantry. You can pay 2 mana to remove one of those counters to draw a card. I've played with that card a fair amount in this format. I don't think it's very good, and I didn't give it a high. I think I gave it an F in the crash course, too. Again, like F is too harsh, probably, but that's a like. It's hard for me to wrap my head around. I'm like, well, I feel like I missed on Builder's Talent, gave that a low grade. I don't think that was worth it. But Stocking the Pantry, I don't think that card is very good. And I am really usually not grading cards with like a do as I say, not as I do. I am often grading it like, I didn't think Bone Cash Overseer was going to be good. I just was like, it seems like how often are you going to be, you know, getting to forage with this derpy 1/1 in play? But I'm, you know, missed that it being a squirrel was going to matter with the cash grab, and like that, then that gave you a food. And I think I probably missed that, like just sacking food, like you didn't need two forage. You could just sack a food to draw the card. And so turning your food into clue tokens, that's pretty good. And so part of it is just missing some things in terms of how things play out when evaluating them in that sort of compressed time. But I think I also am just like, just too pessimistic. And I think just need to be like, rather than like, how can this card fail? Think about, okay, how can this card succeed? And like, how likely do I think that is going
to
happen?
Yeah, that all checks out to me. That rings true to me for sure. I think before we get into individual cards, I want to put my hot take by you.
Okay, here we go.
See what you think here. So I think you'll agree with me. I'm curious to see what your reaction is, but I think you might agree. I think grades largely washed, as we've agreed. So I think grading only matters B minus and higher, like for the cards that pull you into a color. And I think C pluses and below, it just doesn't matter. And for those cards that are C plus and below, it should be archetypes that they go into. Like this goes in only green black, or it goes in green black, green white, green blue, or we expect this to go in only green black, green red. That's a better way to characterize cards, because those cards don't dictate what colors you end up in largely. Like the powerful cards dictate where you end up. And then once you're there, you need to know what C plus and less cards go in that archetype. Like the powerful cards push you towards the archetypes, and then you got to know which cards belong in the archetype.
I almost agree. I feel like C plus matters. Like whatever that tier, like the cream of the crop that doesn't pull you into a color, I do think matters.
Then I got to be more particular about how I hand out C pluses, because I have like 40 C pluses a format or 50.
For sure. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that. And that, like, so if so, then I agree with the B minus or higher matters. But so then can we like, maybe listeners out there could help us, but like, that feels like then there's a doable way to categorize cards. Like then we have like, I mean, it's not ours because that doesn't work, but maybe we do something where like, is there a way for us to categorize cards that takes A's into account, top B's, bottom B's, the C pluses, and then the rest? Like,
well, I think that's what the five R's were kind of trying.
So
to
then,
be.
Do we just need to rebrand that? I mean, we're trying to do it because I agree, and I feel like you and I will run into less problems with our grading differences if we're thinking about cards like that rather than if it's a B minus or a B, you know.
Well, and if it's C plus or lower, maybe it's something like, and this, I'm just flying by the seat of my pants here now, but maybe it's something like, goes in, like we give it a 1, 2, 3, or 4 based on how many decks, how many of the color pairs archetypes we expect it to go in. And then like you can have, rather than synergy grades, you could have like green, red, green, black behind your 2 or whatever, you know, like, and then you know that cards that are more flexible are probably better, like, or at least you're going to be playing with them more often or leave you more flexible or things like that. Something there's, I feel like there's something.
I don't hate 1, 2, 3, 4. I don't hate that at all.
Okay. Like as far as numbers of archetypes that they go in.
Well, and that art that leads you to, so like if something's a 4, like, and then you need an augmentation after it. So then maybe it gets less sexy and less, it's more clunky, but like, cause you know, Saver is a 4. But yes. But Wix Patrol is also a 4, and so, but like,
but Wix Patrol's a B, like, but so right. It's not even going to get a 1, 2, 3, or 4. I'm saying just to try to separate out C pluses and less, because the thing we keep running into with the crash course is like you gave it a D plus and I gave it a C, and then we have to argue about it, but neither one of us thinks the card is format defining, so it doesn't really matter. Right.
Those are the cards I mean? We mostly argue about too. Is like,
yes.
how
important is this highly mediocre card for the format?
Right. Oh man, Crash Course just got 30 minutes shorter, folks. we're not arguing about D's versus C minuses. I don't know where that content's coming from. Okay, so you can do B minus and above grades, and then everything below gets a 1, 2, 3, or 4.
Everything below gets a 1, 2, 3, or 4. And then I think it is important to talk about if we think something's getting a number versus a letter grade. You know what I mean?
Like,
if you think it's not a B minus and I think it's a B minus, like, then those are the real arguments worth having and fighting passionately about.
I'm in. I like this idea. I mean, I've wanted to not do letter grades for a while. And so any excuse to try something new, I like it. Listeners, please let us know if we're off the rails here or not, because
we're probably off the rails.
I think this might, I don't know, the numbers for role players for C plus and below, that I would like that a lot, because I also think, like, there'll be so much information. There's so much more information to see if you give something a 1 and I give it a 4.
Yes.
Right? Like, if you're like, well, I think it's going to be really good in one deck. And I'm like, oh, no. I think this is actually just going to play. Like, that's a cool conversation to have. Whereas, like, we might both give that card a C or a C plus, you know, and then not talk about it.
Right. And then whereas there could be cards like, you know, whatever, the 5 mana 5/5 vanilla, like that could just get a 0 because it doesn't matter. Like, it could be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Right. Like,
okay,
the cards,
yeah,
that just aren't
just
important.
Like, doesn't matter.
Yeah. Like D minuses. Yeah. Whatever, still a way to account for that. But then I think we're saying a more specific thing than D minus D, D plus.
3 is probably not going to come up a lot.
3 archetypes.
It's hard to peg that. Like, I feel like I could see something being clearly in 1, clearly in 2, or clearly in 4. I feel like 3 will be by far the least used number, at least from my side of things.
If we implement this, if the listeners, if the lynch mob of the internet doesn't come for us in recent episode discussion, I don't know, we'll see.
Yeah. Shall we touch base on some more of the misses from this format and maybe unpack them a little bit?
Yes, please.
So we talked about Builder's Talent. What happened with Plume Creed Escort, the 1 blue 2/1? Flash flyer that gave something hexproof on ETB. You were kind of low on this.
Yeah, I was just wrong. I think what I was thinking was it was nothing about it was right. Whereas, like, by the time you saved it to give something hexproof, you didn't really care about the 2/1 flyer, and that the 2/1 flyer on 2 wasn't that good. But it's just a powerful card, which is what you were saying when we argued about it.
And this would, I think I gave this a B at the time. I don't think I would now. But I would give this a 4.
This would be
now.
A 4. Yes. I think so.
God, that just feels good. I'm going to say.
Doesn't it feel good? Like, it doesn't pull you into blue, but it goes in every blue archetype, and it's going to be a great card there.
That's clean, baby. That is clean. Okay, we talked about Shoreline Looter. We were both too low on that. Do you agree with my take about, like, the cheap hand smoothing stuff? I mean, you do, because you talked about it. Finds your best cards.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Shoreline Looter, just good. Doesn't matter that it's a 2-mana 1/1. Eddie Merc Crab. This is the Ben Wernie Invitational card of the format. Has to be, right? You love this card.
I love this style of card always. Yeah. Giant crab, giant sea serpent. Sign me up.
That can get a little cheaper. We were just too high on it, though.
Yeah, but some of that, that's what I wanted to dive into here. Like, I think some of that is a function of the format. Like, I don't regret being too high on uh-huh. Eddie Merc Crab. Like, Shoreline Looter, I think we just missed on.
Yes.
I think it is appropriate during card grading season to be high on Eddie Merc Crab, because if the format context is different, and it's so hard to peg best archetypes, best color without playing with the cards,
mm-hmm.
if blue is the best archetype or blue-red spells is a good deck, Eddie Merc Crab is the grade we gave it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't regret being too high on Eddie Merc Crab. I don't think there were grading mistakes there.
Okay, yeah, I think that's fair. So there's, yeah, I think that's why we are obsessed with this game. That's why we've been podcasting about it for 7 years. Like, is that you can't just solve the puzzle, right, by just looking at the cards.
No, for sure not.
And so I think that's good to shout out that, like, okay, Shoreline Looter, that's a mistake. We should have, I think that's, there's a takeaway there. Not sure there's a takeaway for Eddie Merc Crab necessarily.
Other than that, you got to play with cards, but also that I'm ready for the MTG auto battler at any point in time. Find me out.
Yeah, Ben revealed to me, he was like, I'll watch any draft videos you post. Gameplay, not so much, but I'll watch the drafts. Bone Cash Overseer talked about that, about me missing on that. Downwind Ambusher, one of the top performing uncommons in the set. One of, I think, the best uncommons in the set. One of, you know, if we were to make that list of cards that matter, like uncommons that really move the needle of games they're cast in, I would put Downwind Ambusher on that list. Both too low on it.
Both too low on it. And I think we probably missed on this because of the prevailing wisdom I think that both you and I have at this point, that four mana value cards are replaceable. Like a four mana value card has to be really special to matter in that slot. And does that need to be revisited? Or maybe did we just miss how special Downwind Ambusher was? That's probably more what it was, that we think that four mana value cards are replaceable and are quick to judge that way. And that extra line of text on Downwind Ambusher, the -1/-1 ability, was enough to make this a special four mana value card.
I think there's that, but I think both are true. I think we missed how special -1/-1 was on this card as an addition to the text we're used to seeing on these flash four drops in black. But also, like, Tree Guard Duo comes to mind as a card. It's not on this list, but we missed on it. Like, I think I gave that a C- or something. That's a four, baby. And, you know, it's not, like, I don't think it's B- level, but I do think it goes in every green deck, and it's strong in every green deck. And I do think I had a lot of, like, well, Tree Guard Duo and Treetop Sentries and, I forget the name of it, but the 4/4 with Offspring Raccoon. Like, all these green four drops feel, you know, I staked my claim for centuries thinking like that was going to be the one. It's Giant Spider, it draws you a card, it's a squirrel, etc. I think Tree Guard Duo won out in that of that trio of cards, but I think I need to walk back my thoughts a little bit about being too hard on four drops. Because another thing that I feel like I do is when I see that, well, green has three different four drops at common,
but none of them matter because you're going to get
like,
one of them.
You'll get one, but there's a real spread there in
right.
terms
Tree Guard Duo is definitely better than the others.
Correct. And so I think I'm going to walk back my feelings about four drops and grading those too harshly. And try and identify the Tree Guard Duos and certainly the Downwind Ambushers of the world.
Right. Just to be more critical thinking about four drops.
Mm-hmm.
Next one, Blacksmith's Talent. We were both way too low on this card.
And I think going back to the, like, this is why we love the game, is that some cards, like, I just think there are going to be cards like this where one, like, I will not be able to correctly picture how they play out until I see them. And I think that's just got to be okay with that. I want to think about specifically this card, like how I could have maybe seen it. Like, because you and I were really high on Valiant going into Bloomborough.
Mm-hmm.
Valiant didn't end up playing out. Like, we were like, oh man, red white looks like it's going to run away with the format. And it didn't. And I definitely saw the Blacksmith's Talent, but I'm not even sure I saw that this gave you a free Valiant trigger every turn. And that's not even why this card is good.
No, it's once you get it to level three that it's broken.
And the fact that for one more mana, because I was like, equip two, but you just only have to spend the three mana once to get it to level two, and then you're never spending an equip cost again.
And that is easier to fit into your curve. And then once you're giving things haste double strike, your opponent just has to live in fear the rest of the game.
Okay, so this is just right off the cuff, because I think about this. It's hard for me not to think about Blacksmith's Talent without thinking about how sick it is with Starforged Sword. You get a free, like, you don't even have to gift the fish with the sword, and you get to free equip any equipment with talent, including the sword. Where does sword go on the new scale? Because it's not a four, but it's not a zero, and it doesn't go in a specific deck.
I think sword's a zero.
Sword's a zero.
I would say, but like, during preview season, sword would be
a zero. That doesn't
it's either a zero or a four as an artifact, or maybe we need some sort of qualifier for artifacts, because they also have 10 color pairs that they can go in.
Well, but there's
so
there's,
an artifact could be a 10.
That could be a 10. That's true. But like, you play sword. But I guess it's never a thing that you're like actively seeking, which makes it a zero.
I don't think so. Like, sword's like a 21st type card.
Yeah, even
shoot, this archetype doesn't function without a sword, you know?
Right. Yeah. Okay, that's fair. Stocking the Pantry, I was low on, and I maintain that is right. Do you disagree?
I think my grade of build around D was right. I think it is.
That's not a grade.
Yes, you're right. It's a build around card. Build around D is bad. It's a synergy, like D or D plus. Like it is a card that has a very narrow case use range.
Like if everything goes right,
then you'll play.
Then you'll play it.
Play Stocking the Pantry, and it will be good.
Mm-hmm.
And you never have to go out of your way to try to pick it up.
And if everything goes right and you don't end up with Stocking the Pantry, your deck is still good.
Correct. But yeah. But it's not an F. Like that's wrong, because that means you dismiss it. Like that it's very narrow.
Okay. That's fair. And so on the new scale, it would be a zero.
A zero A.
Okay. Fire Glass Mentor. Black red 2/1. If you've dealt damage at the beginning of your second main phase. If your opponent lost life at the beginning of your second main phase, you exile the top two cards of your library, and until the end of turn, you can play one of them. Too low on this card.
I think this is a nod to your point about stats. Like, vanilla test, this does very poor on.
Right. Two mana, this two ones, like, blah.
This is basically an enchantment. But the times your opponent misses their two drop, this is insane, which happens some percentage of the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then also just... this format in particular really wanted you to have ways to draw cards or filter through cards.
Yeah.
And this was that for a deck that didn't get it many other ways. I think we should have seen that Fireglass Mentor was a little bit better.
I think that's true. I think, again, like, it's hard for me because I look at it and I'm like, this is so mopey, but I think I really need to start to enact that idea of, like, don't be such a rate, you know,
A slave to rate,
especially early in the curve. I think you can get away with something like this. And the other thing that I have in my notes that I haven't said yet is just, like, part of that conversation I'm having with myself about thinking of ceilings versus floors a lot more is not every deck and game is just curve out, beat down, ships passing in the night. And I think it's really easy for me to default to that of, like, this doesn't affect the board. This doesn't do the thing. You're not getting a good thing for your rate. What if your opponent just goes ba 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 ba? Yeah, sometimes that happens. But, like, games do go long and engines are strong, like, from set to set to set. And, like, I think something like this, like Fireglass Mentor, does, you know, demand an answer at some point.
Yes.
You know, unless you are doing the thing where you're truly just getting them dead. But I don't think that happens all the time.
Next up is Patchwork Banner. We were both too low on this. This is another one I think we could have or should have seen, right? Like, if you are a streamlined archetype, this was a kindred or whatever they're calling it now format. And I think if you end up in a great deck, Patchwork Banner is going to be great for you. Like, 3 mana, +1/+1 to your, like, an anthem for your team. Is a good Magic card.
You know what? Another card that's... I agree with that. And I think the other thing that we missed on or eventually got to, and this was, I think, something I got to in 17 lands, had this in the top 10 uncommons, was I was like, oh, you can just take this early. Because, like, you're trying to get one of those streamlined decks. And this will... once you get that, this is going to be great. So why not take this early? And then
it helps you delay the decision to figure out which one's open. Yeah.
Exactly. And also just the fact that, like, this also played out, like, it's fine if this only anthems, you know, doesn't have to anthem every single creature you have in play for it to be good either. I think Fountainport Bell also slots into the conversation about, like, for me personally, I missed on this card. I thought this was going to be really bad. And this goes into the same, like, it's not at the same level of smoothing your draws like Carrot Cake and Cash Grab, etc. But it does give you optionality in the early turns like that to be able to say, like, I'm going to hit my land drop. I'm going to hit my second color. And then it's a little bit of a speed bump to have to say, like, later on, you, like, draw it as a, oh, I don't actually want to do this. I'll just cycle it. I don't want to top a land. I'll cycle it. Yeah, that's not ideal, but that flexibility I do think is something I want to, you know, I've gotten on board with, like, the hidden grotto kind of land, like having that Surveil or that Scry, that does do more than when those lands didn't have that, when they were just tap for colorless or filter. I think everybody knew, like, those lands were kind of garbage, but it didn't take much. Tacking on the Scry one or the Surveil one to those does really give it some power. And again, that goes into, for cheap or for nothing, you're getting a little bit of smoothing in your developing turns.
Yeah, that bell's a 10. 10's a high number.
10's a high number. That's I like the numbers. All right, can we talk about the other 6-mana Flame Tongue Kavu in the format? Or maybe we need to talk about both Wix Patrol and Daring Wave Rider.
I think we can talk about both because I think it's an interesting conversation. So I was higher than you on both of these cards, and I probably gave them both the same grade, would be my guess. I probably gave them both a B-, I think, and you probably didn't have them as pulling you into their respective colors.
I think I
colors.
Had them as Cs or something, yeah.
And but some of that is, I think, your leak of being too hard on expensive cards.
Correct.
For being too low on them. And for me, like, I don't regret the grade I gave either of these cards. Like, I think a 2-for-1 in Magic should pull you into a color generally, unless the format is just absurd, like Neon Dynasty or something where everything's 3-for-1 or whatever, you know,
or if it's blisteringly fast and 6-mana cards really do get punished in the way that I punish them in every set.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think one of my grades panned out, one didn't. Like the Wix Patrol grade was actually probably a little too low and the Daring Wave Rider was definitely too high, but that's more a function of the format context as a whole, where it's impossible to know ahead of time which colors are going to be best and which archetypes are going to be best. I mean, we can guess and you can make educated guesses, but ultimately you don't know. But I think fine to have given those cards those grades and be right about one, wrong about the other, because I think both of those cards are powerful cards. In a different format, Daring Wave Rider is a B-. Quite easily, I think, if blue's the best color and if spells have more stuff going on, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
One does have, I think the one thing to note between the two cards is that Wix Patrol enables itself and Daring Wave Rider does not. Like, so I think it is a little bit disingenuous to look at both of them and say, well, both of them are Flame Tongue copies, both of them are B-. So it does make sense that Wix Patrol panned out in that sense and Daring Wave Rider didn't, because Daring Wave Rider does take work and it turns out the format doesn't incentivize you to want to do the work. For Daring Wave Rider, whereas Wix Patrol just turns itself on and also helps feed the best mechanics. I mean, some of that is format context, but I think ultimately that type of card should get a high grade.
I have to grade Daring Wave Rider highly in future sets, is what you're telling me?
I think so. It's a 2-for-1.
It's a 2-for-1. Everything's a 2-for-1.
No,
it's not special.
Not in this format.
No, not in this format for sure. That's true. That's the thing. Like, yeah, just trying to identify that as well, because some formats are 2-for-1 dot deck and some are not, and this is definitely not, which leads to, I mean, Saver is just a big miss for both of us, I think. And I was trying to think about why this wasn't in a lot of our conversations until after the crash course, and I looked back because I was like, well, like, sometimes the deal twos don't matter, and 2-mana for, you know, the Disfigure variant, this feels like a little meh, but not really. Like, you know, you had Wither and Bloom in MH3, and despite Black not performing super well, like, that was still a top common in that color, and Desert's Dew in Outlaws of Thunder's Junction was good, and that's the same, like, kind of thing, like, -2/-2 for 2-mana, plus maybe additional -1/-1 if you have Deserts. Like 2-mana deal 2, I think, is bad, but 2-mana -2/-2 is a big difference.
Right, I think that's why I missed, if we're talking about why we missed. I think I looked at Saver as 2-mana shock plus a food, which I wasn't super high on, and it's way more than that.
Yeah, the fact that you get to use it in combat, and the food was, like, it really mattered in this set. And I guess, like,
yes.
The other thing is, I think I was, and I'll speak for myself, but I would imagine you probably did this too, like, the last time we saw a lot of food was Lord of the Rings, and food didn't matter. It wasn't that good. And so I was thinking about that similarly here. Like, both of us were pretty trepidatious of the Black-Green Squirrels deck. We were like, I hope it's good. It seems like a cool thing to do, but I don't know if it'll be good. And it ended up being great. And Saver's a big part of that.
Yeah, I would concur with all of that.
Number scale, huh?
I don't know. I don't know if that's it or not. But I think the overarching thoughts that I feel ring true to me are that the B-minus cards and above need letter grades and need separating out and careful separating out. Like, I tend to not give much. Once I know that it pulls me into a color, I tend to not give much thought to how much, like, it pulls me into a color. Like, how heavy is that pull? How great is this card? I don't think that much about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that rings true to me is that the cards that don't pull me into a color, the letter grade I give them doesn't matter. And here's why even more. Like I said, I tend to end up with 40 to 50 C pluses and probably 40 to 50 Cs, like a lot, you know, whatever. Yeah. I guess there's only 80 commons, so that's an exaggeration.
But yeah.
I end up with a lot of C pluses and Zs. And ultimately, I don't, like, I still am rating them against each other. Like, I'm coming up with a mental tier list of how much I value each card. And the letter grade is nowhere in that equation. It's, does this go in multiple archetypes? How flexible is this card? Have I liked playing with this card? And then I'm rating them against each other within those, like, as soon as I start playing with the cards, like, all of the letter grades, C plus and below, largely go out the window. Like, it just doesn't matter. What matters is, does it have homes? Does it have multiple homes? How synergistic is it? Like, none of it is it a C?
Like, the thing that I really like about this proposed number system is how much information is conveyed with one character. That, like, we used to be like, synergy C plus, and that just feels so overbearing, whereas you just get to say one, which lets you know, I don't think it's a pull, but I do think it has a really good home somewhere. You get to say four, I don't think it's a pull, but I do think it's going to go in every white deck. It's a zero, I don't think it's going to pull you into a deck, but maybe, and then whatever, maybe we have augmentations. It's a zero A, as you said before, like, you've got a...
Well, but Stocking in the Pantry truly should get a zero, right?
A zero.
If you go through the, if you go through the whole format, never having played Stocking in the Pantry, you're fine. Like, you haven't missed on anything.
There's a lot to like about that, how much information is conveyed with just the number in that little system. And then you still get the letter grades,
broader
the cards,
conversation. The number can lead to a broader conversation too, also. And then, like, scales of shale, presumably, if it gets a one, you would, I think, safe to assume that you know the one is lizards.
You know the one is lizards. But the, and that would that get a
and
one?
And maybe, the, maybe, the, maybe the number system doesn't work as well in formats that are less, like, there's no bleed in Bloomborough, right? So it's easy to say, well, the number there, system looks great here.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Maybe we'll see how that pans out for Duskmourne. But I do think, like, there's a lot of secret gold stuff happening in sets that aren't even typal sets, you know?
Do you know what we need to do?
Oh, no.
We can just bring it
full, circle.
Full circle stars. To stars. One star, two star, three star, four stars. It's a deep cut there for our OG Lords of Limited.
For the OG Lords of Limited listeners, we did a like Yelp style review for our first ever set review using a star grading system. And you might notice that we've never returned to it, so we didn't love it.
In defense of the star rating system, though, I think we were trying to differentiate ourselves as a podcast from limited resources. So I think the thought behind it was correct, and I think we've done a good job making a separate podcast from limited resources. But anyway, on that note, the star rating system for the OG listeners, great place to wrap us up. Thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen.
You can find all of our content on our website at lordsoflimited.com. Links to our tier lists, which maybe we'll now have to figure out how to implement some numbers there in the tier lists instead of the letter grades. 17 lands, if you're listening. You want to overhaul the tier list system as well, like us? No, but you can find our tier list there. You can find our episode backlogs, our YouTube channel, our Twitch streams, respectively, our merch, courtesy of TeePublic, our Patreon page, all of that stuff linked at lordsoflimited.com.
If you got any feedback about the show or any questions, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.